You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Just yesterday, President Trump rescinded protections for transgender students that had allowed them to use bathrooms corresponding with their gender identity. The decision pitted Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who has vigorously opposed any expansion of gay, lesbian, and transgender rights, against Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who expressed her concerns about potential harm to transgender students. The rollback of LGBTQ rights is not confined to the United States, as journalist Masha Gessen reports in an article called Family Values, Mapping the Spread of Anti-Gay Ideology. It's in the March issue of Harper's Magazine, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Masha Gessen back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You lived in Russia until your mid-teens in 1981 and then returned on assignment some years later, but then you fled again in 2013. What happened?
What happened was that the government threatened to take away our kids because they were being raised by lesbians. So we decided not to take any chances with that and got out in a hurry.
But wasn't there a time when Vladimir Putin didn't seem to be much concerned about homosexual matters? You say that he wasn't concerned about people's private lives until 2012 when he started talking about traditional values. What happened?
Well, what happened was that he had come back into office for his third term as president, faced for the first time with popular resistance all over the country. There were mass protests. And he launched a political crackdown. For political crackdown, you need a few things. One of them is you need an other. And so the other of choice were the queers. He queer-baited the protesters. He also used the anti-gay campaign as part of this, and this should now sound familiar to American listeners, as part of this trope, you know, of the imaginary past. It communicated to people very effectively that Putin was promising to take them back to a time they don't quite remember, but when they are certain they felt more comfortable than now.
At first, when Vladimir Putin began passing the so-called homosexual propaganda laws, you say they seemed ridiculous, so you didn't pay attention. When did they begin to demand your attention?
Well, they first passed in a number of small towns around the country, first in small towns and sort of medium-sized towns, and then they got to St. Petersburg, and I think that's probably when I started paying attention. And also because, you know, it seemed that the term homosexual propaganda seemed so quaint to me. It sounded like something out of the 1970s, some sort of Anita Bryant throwback. So I wasn't taking it seriously until someone pointed out to me that because it was framed as the defense of children, I could be seeing my own children being defended from me. And sure enough, that's exactly what ended up happening.
Do these attitudes reflect anti-gay thinking that you're likely to find throughout Russia and Eastern Europe?
I think it works the other way around. And I'm not trying to say that people in Russia or elsewhere in Eastern Europe aren't homophobic people. You can find homophobic people everywhere. And certainly the fewer openly gay people there are, the more people will be likely to express homophobic attitudes. But most Russians, I think, didn't think about LGBT people until the Kremlin began pushing its anti-gay agenda. And it's like with any process of othering. You know, how concerned were Americans with Muslims in the 1990s? Not terribly. You know, some of them may have harbored anti-Muslim sentiments, and most of them just never gave it any thought until it suddenly became a sort of public priority number one, which is what happened in Russia with LGBT people.
You live in New York City now, and you say that there are many Russian gay refugees here. Did they apply for asylum because they felt threatened by Putin's government?
That's exactly what happened. I mean, you know, nobody leaves their home because they feel like it and they think it will be fun. People leave everything they know to look for a new life elsewhere because they feel desperate, because they feel like staying home is more dangerous than going to a place where they know no one and, you know, initially at least can't even work legally. So there are hundreds of LGBT asylum seekers in New York City alone. I'm talking about people from Russia. And there are many, many more people all over the country.
What are the risks in Russia for openly gay men and women? Is there still a functioning LGBTQ movement in the country?
Well, there was never much of a movement to begin with, and I don't mean to discount the efforts of the activists who do exist, but Russia was sort of in the community building stages of an LGBT movement before the anti-gay campaign began. It didn't have a strong political movement. And all of a sudden, these people who were really concerned with, you know, organizing socials and film festivals had to become political actors because they were made into political actors. And they've done a terrific job. But for most people, the consequence of the anti-gay campaign, it's not the enforcement of the ban on homosexual propaganda, which is a classic, you know, law that says nothing specific, so it can be enforced randomly and can be used just as a tool of oppression. The biggest consequence is violence. There's street violence, there's organized violence on LGBT spaces. There's TV violence. Yeah.
Haven't there been reports of gay men being lured into what they think are dates only to be beaten by homophobic gangs?
Yeah, I wrote an article about that for the New York Times about a year ago after yet another murder of that type. And what I realized was happening was that I was starting to recognize obituaries. Like if you read an obituary of a man who was found stabbed to death in his own apartment and there was no sign of forced entry, it would always turn out to be that kind of story because it is increasingly dangerous for gay men to meet out in public. The people meet online predominantly, and also because many spaces have been destroyed, people meet online and they invite people to their houses to avoid being out in public. But that's a perfect setup for anybody who wants to engage in anti-gay violence, which is so strongly encouraged from the top.
Do they wind up going to jail if they have beaten or killed a gay man?
Sometimes, and on at least two occasions, people who have been arrested for these kinds of murders have said that they did it out of principle, that they intended to commit an anti-gay murder. At least in one case, the testimony actually contained the words patriotic and patriotic duty, and the person was unpatriotic for being queer.
My guest is Masha Gessen, who writes primarily in English these days, although she's been called Russia's leading LGBT rights activist. Her articles have appeared everywhere, and she's written a number of books. Also serves as a Russian translator of the TV show The Americans. Most recent book to be published in the fall will be The Future is History. How many of your books have been published in Russian?
One. Out of my 10 books, one has been published in Russian, and it's a book about a mathematician. Most others have in some way or another been sort of too politically problematic.
Because books with titles like The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, or Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, are considered a little too dangerous for publishers to touch?
Yes, exactly.
But would they be officially banned in Russia, or is it just that publishers are unwilling to take the risk?
It's publishers are unwilling to take the risk, and that's a very interesting way in which censorship works in Russia now. It's basically profit-based. Publishers, the state doesn't tell publishers what they can't publish, but there are a number of laws that are randomly enforced against bookstores and publishers. Laws on extremism, which is, you know, whenever you hear the word extremism, you know that that's an attack on freedom of speech, and homosexual propaganda, and other laws that regulate the dissemination of information to minors. So because all of these regulations are really vague, publishers tend to be extra careful. Bookstores tend to be even more careful because they're also afraid of vigilante groups that take it upon themselves to enforce laws, even if the police are not doing it. So basically, if a publisher sees a book that they think bookstores are not going to accept for distribution, then they will not publish a book, and they think that this is an economic decision.
For your article in Harper's, you traveled to Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia. Had you been there before?
I've been there a few times. It's a lovely city.
And you write that it has endured the end of the Soviet Union, a civil war, a revolution. Is it does it bear the marks of that?
It absolutely bears the marks of that. I mean, it's a beautiful city sort of wedged between the mountains. It's very, very old. It's also dilapidated. It's sort of full of temporary structures that probably were meant to be temporary 50 years ago and have become permanent. You can tell that the country is quite poor and has been through a lot of trauma. And the reason I traveled there was because the World Congress of Families, which is a fascinating organization, was holding its semi-regular Congress there in Tbilisi.
Its 10th Congress in the Tbilisi Congress. Concert Hall. This is a pretty big concert hall.
The opening ceremony had 2,200 people there. The hall was filled.
How many countries are represented?
I can't give you an exact count, but there are basically two sort of groups of countries. This now feels like ancient history. The Congress was less than a year ago, but it was at a different time in history when the Western Europeans and the Americans seemed embattled and felt embattled, and we're talking about all those horrible advances in transgender rights and in marriage equality, and how were they going to fight back against this onslaught of attacks on the family? And the Eastern Europeans are the proud ones, the ones who brag of all the advances that they have made in their battle against what they call gender ideology. Since then, things have changed. I think that Americans are going to have a lot to brag about at the next Congress.
But although you do hear some similar things from this Congress, from what we hear from conservative groups in the United States, the essential narrative is that the family, the natural family, is one that consists of one man and one woman and their biological children, which is the foundation of human civilization.
Right. And so the basic narrative is that that I heard at the Congress, and it was repeated by various speakers and during various workshops, that's sort of the unifying story of this organization, is that there is a culture of death and a culture of life. The culture of death is represented by proponents of what they call gender ideology, by LGBT activists. And the culture of life, is represented by the defenders of the so-called natural family, the opponents of abortion and contraception of all kinds, and opponents, of course, of LGBT rights. They are warning of an apocalyptic scenario in which humankind will die out. If you look at the graphs, if you sort of tune out the words and look at the statistic that they're showing, what they're really warning about is that they're afraid that the white race will die out. But they're a little bit too polite to say that out loud.
Although you do say that race, the language in general, would be kind of shocking here. White race. They don't use phrases like LGBT. They say pervert.
Well, it actually depends on who's talking. The Western Europeans and the Americans and the Australians are rather embarrassed by their Eastern European comrades who will use words like pervert speaking on the stage. The Western Europeans like to say LGBT. And then call on a full attack on LGBT rights, but at least they don't like to use the word pervert.
They talk about gender ideology. How do they define that?
Well, there isn't a single definition, but gender ideology is a term that I've come across a lot, both in this country and in Eastern Europe and in Australia. In Australia, I've seen leaflets distributed by the opponents of the Safe Schools movement in Australia. And these leaflets warn of the impending sort of domination of gender ideology. Gender ideology is a vague term that I think encompasses the idea that gender is sexually constructed, and that there is such a thing as transgender rights, that there is such a thing as LGBT rights. But the phrase itself conjures the specter of a totalitarian ideology that is forcing itself onto these poor, unsuspecting people in these countries. And I think it taps into something very deep in Eastern Europe, especially in countries that used to be part of the Soviet Empire, that have a lived experience of having lived with a totalitarian ideology that was imposed on them by a foreign power. And so it's very easy to frame this idea that the Western world is pushing its ideology down their throats in the same terms.
I'm speaking with Masha Gessen, whose article, Family Values, Mapping the Spread of Anti-Gay Ideology, is in the March issue of Harper's Magazine. And we have a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Masha Gessen, who's written an article for Harper's in the March issue of Harper's called Family Values, Mapping the Spread of Anti-Gay Ideology. And as I mentioned, much of this involves your traveling to Tbilisi, where you attended the 10th World Congress of Families, the WCF meeting. Where does this group get its funding from?
It's not a huge group, and I didn't actually investigate its funding that much. I think it's all pretty much out in the open. I was much more interested in its history, because I think there's this idea that emerged a few years ago when the anti-gay campaign started in Russia. There was this idea that Americans are exporting hate to Eastern Europe and especially to Russia because the Christian right in the States had lost traction and had to take its wares elsewhere. And that's sort of the story that I thought I was going to find once I started writing about the World Congress of Families. It's much more complicated, much more interesting. The World Congress of Families actually had its start in a sort of convergence of the minds of an American, extremely conservative American historian called Alan Carlson and a couple of Russian sociologists in the early 1990s. And they were basing their sort of meeting of the minds on the work of Peterim Sorokin, who was a Russian exile. He was exiled by Lenin, and he founded the sociology department at Harvard. He is considered the founder of modern sociology in this country. But one of his ideas was that the Western civilization was in decline and was sort of going to descend into decadence. And it tapped very well into the sense of demographic panic in Eastern Europe after the breakup of the Eastern Bloc, when all these tiny nations became nation states again, and I think realized that they were small. And a lot of them were also experiencing depopulation, Russia especially. So there was this great fear of the unknown, this great fear of dwindling numbers, combined with a nostalgia for an imaginary past, and an intellectual footing to be found in the work of Sorokin and his contemporary follower Alan Carlson, all this led to the formation of the World Congress of Families, which is actually not an American organization as much as it was an Eastern European organization originally. And the Americans have been sort of they've given the intellectual wares, while the Eastern Europeans have given the bodies and the money. A lot of the money seems to come from Russia, and a lot of the political muscle seems to come from Russia. I think that's about to change. You know, there's certainly a lot more political muscle in the States now than there was when I was reporting this story less than a year ago.
You've been targeted by right-wing family values advocates as a representative of the enemy, someone who has personally set out to destroy the natural family. So why did Larry Jacobs, the managing director of WCF, decide to defy many members and agree to let you attend? Although, as you write, you had there were all sorts of terms of it was all had to be negotiated.
Well, it's not unusual to have to negotiate full access to a gathering, especially to a closed gathering, and everyone there knew that I probably wasn't going to write a flattering story about it. But I was surprised that Larry Jacobs was interested. I think that part of what got me in was I was reporting for a mainstream American magazine, which, again, you know, I keep saying that it's like having time traveled, because to imagine that they felt so embattled in May of last year during this Congress that interest from a mainstream American magazine was, I think, flattering and was just more exposure than this kind of politics was getting and certainly this organization was getting. So Larry Jacobs wanted a guarantee from me that I wasn't going to just do a hostile sort of hack job. And I told him nobody is interested in a piece that talks about how horrible the World Congress is for 5,000 words. That's not going to be a whole lot of fun to read. I really did want to try to figure out what made this organization and these activists tick.
Were you the only openly queer Jewish anti-Putin critic of one man, one woman marriage as an institution attendee?
I think I may have been the only one in any single category that you have just listed off.
And you report that everybody assumed Donald Trump wasn't going to win presidency, so they saw the situation as being dangerous in the United States as well.
Well, of course, this was May of last year. So really sort of the rhetoric of it was, we are an embattled people. We, the defenders of the natural family, are embattled. The progress of LGBT rights and transgender rights is inexorable. That was sort of the leitmotif. And a lot of why that activism was sort of focused internationally was because I think they didn't have a whole lot of hope for fighting against marriage equality and fighting against transgender rights in the United States. It's a really good reminder of the fact that progress is never inexorable. To be recording this interview on the day that the day after the safety provisions for transgender students in schools are rescinded by the Trump administration is symbolic.
I'm speaking with Masha Gessen. Her article, Family Values, Mapping the Spread of Anti-Gay Ideology, is in the March issue of Harper's Magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. After the first day of Congress, you attended a lavish dinner. The Russians in attendance refused to speak to you, but you ended up dining with a man you have just talked about, Alan Carlson. He was happy to talk with you?
I don't know if he was happy to talk with me, but he was genial, and we actually had a lovely conversation. I think we were both sort of acting in good faith. He was in good faith trying to get his views across to me, and a lot of what he said is compelling. And, you know, I think it's important sort of not ridicule this. It's very easy to ridicule ideas like gender ideology or culture of death and culture of life. But I think, for someone like Alan Carlson, who's a very intelligent and thoughtful man, this comes from years of sort of working and thinking. He has come to the considered conclusion that the natural family is the So the bulwark of civilization. And his and my disagreement is really on the definition of family, right? I think that the idea that that small groups of people, that the private world needs to be protected against a hostile state is an idea that is that both of us find compelling. It's just that I think that a family can be constituted in any way imaginable, you know, including by one person. One person also has a right to defend their private world against a hostile state, whereas he thinks that the family can only be composed of one man, one woman, and their biological children.
Do they see themselves as kind of losing the war in Western Europe because so many of the Western European countries are now recognizing same-sex marriage and abortion rights are being granted in more of those countries? All sorts of other things that the WCF is opposed to seem to be the wave of the future, although the battles do continue in each of those, in all of those countries.
So the basic tenor of the conversation in May of last year was countries like Poland saying, don't lose hope. We are succeeding in fighting back against abortion rights and in eliminating gender and sex education in schools and reintroducing religious education in schools. And Western European countries sort of crying on their shoulder and complaining about all the new laws being adopted. I mean, Italy had just become the 27th country in Europe to recognize same-sex unions, not even same-sex marriage. I mean, it was a very limited piece of legislation in Italy. But to that crowd, it was a huge loss in a Catholic country. I think things have changed. I mean, we have the Trump administration in the United States. There are a lot of right-wing parties that are starting to become politically dominant forces in their countries. And their extremely conservative agenda and this idea of this imaginary past that really lends itself to attacks on LGBT rights and transgender rights, those kinds of parties have gained so much traction just in the 9 months that have passed.
Does the WCF have much of a presence in the United States? Hasn't the Southern Poverty Law Center classified them as a hate group?
The Southern Poverty Law Center considers them a hate group. They, until recently, haven't had much of a presence. There's another organization called the National Organization on Marriage, which has fought more political battles in the United States. It was formed to fight Proposition 8 or to defend Proposition 8 in California to fight against same-sex marriage in California. They lost, but that's how they sort of got their political legs. And the head of that organization, Brian Brown, has now become president of the World Congress of Families. And my most memorable interview at that Congress was with Brian Brown.
You write about the best speech at the conference, which came from an Eastern European, Vasadze. Who is he, and what did he talk about?
So Levon Vasadze was the host in Georgia. He is a Georgian-Russian businessman and philanthropist. He has become publicly prominent in Georgia just since 2013. What happened in 2013 there was that there was an attack on an LGBT rally. It was Idaho, the International Day Against Homophobia, which is a pretty low-key sort of celebration. It's not like a pride parade. And people were showing up in Tbilisi for Idaho on May 17th, 2013, and they got attacked by at least 1,000 bat and stone-wielding thugs. People were chased through the streets. It was basically a pogrom that lasted all day. And at the end of the day, the patriarch of the Georgian church celebrated mass at the main cathedral in the city and proclaimed a victory for the church and the family in Georgia after those pogroms. And following that, the patriarch declared May 17th in Georgia the family and defense of family or something like that day. Vasadze is instrumental in that movement, the movement of, some people think that he was instrumental in bussing in the thugs who beat people up, but he's certainly been the most visible face of the anti-gay movement in Georgia, and he was the architect of bringing the WCF to Georgia. And he's gorgeous. He's an amazing speaker. He speaks excellent English. He was educated at Emory University on a full scholarship because it's also in Georgia, and that pun never fails to work.
Yes, it definitely works. It confuses a lot of people, too.
Right. So he gave this incredible speech that really, in some ways I found truly compelling, because the story that he tells is this is a story of a struggle for self-determination of this tiny nation that has faced so many wars and so much so many attacks, and especially from Russia. I mean, its last war with Russia was less than 10 years ago, in 2008. And it turned westward, hoping to find freedom there. But he says instead, the West is pushing its own agenda and its own ideology down Georgians' throats. And the ancient civilization doesn't feel like it can get any respect from either Russia or the West.
He says some of his biggest fears come from the growth of agencies like Child Protective Services in Georgia. I would think that left and right, people would be concerned about the protection of children.
Child Protection Services are a huge boogeyman in all over Eastern Europe. I think there's a reason for that. I think the reason is that the idea that the state can be trusted to make decisions about families is highly suspect in Eastern Europe. I think this is exactly what sort of Alan Carlson taps into when he talks about the family against the hostile state. The experience of Eastern Europeans who lived under Soviet occupation or in the Soviet Union, in their own country, is the experience of barely being able to carve out any sort of breathing and loving and child-raising space away from the state. So it is a genuinely threatening idea. And most of these states have certainly failed to establish any kind of trust that would be necessary to make the idea of state-run child protection services credible.
Masha Gessen, her book is coming out this fall. I'm looking forward to speaking to you about it. The Future is History from Riverhead. But we've been talking about her article in the March issue of Harper's Magazine, Family Values, Mapping the Spread of Anti-Gay Ideology. You can find a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/lopate. Masha, as always, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.